He's got two other spaceships very similar to this being built in his factory now. So by the time they're done, they'll have three of these. They'll have different places to take off from. Right now, they've taken off from California at Edwards Spaceport, they call it, out of California, down there, their test area. And after all the testing is done, they're going to move to New Mexico, to Spaceport America, they call it. It's been built and ready to go for many years now. They would be doing this probably 4 or 5 years ago. But that's where they're going to be. So if you take a ride on this thing, you go out to New Mexico, a couple of days, they train you how to, you know, everything that you're going to have to do when you go up. And off you go for, I think, you know, the whole trip up there is pretty long, too, on this airplane. So it's like, an hour or two just to get to where you got to go. And then you blast into space and come back on a runway. Overall, I think they said the whole thing is around 4 hours.
Roy, Paul, you called the engine a hybrid engine. What is it using for fuel? Why is it called a hybrid engine? Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of different kinds of rubber or some kind of like neoprene type of material. They're using a combination. So, and they changed from the earlier one, whatever it was, I forgot. They didn't like, it wasn't as much power as this. This has more thrust. And I'm not really sure the chemical breakdown. I can look into it. It's been described as, taking rubber tires and, shaping it into almost like a solid booster, like a solid engine. The difference with this is it's throttleable. It's a regular solid booster engine. You can't do anything with it. You light it. You can't shut it off. You can't relight it. They say this thing you can.
Okay. It's burning something like rubber. Does it also have an oxygen tank? And the rubber-like material, is that some kind of a liquid that you can throttle? Paul, go ahead.
Whatever this is must contain oxygen within itself. It's not running liquid oxygen.
So you're saying the total fuel supply to run that engine is all in one tank, and that you throttle into the rocket engine is what it sounds like. There isn't a separate oxidizer and a separate fuel being mixed together in the ignition chamber of the rocket engine. Unusual. Over to you, Paul.
That's what I read. And that's their design. They needed something, they said, simple. They didn't need all these pumping valves and, turbines and all kinds of piping and, safety valves. And, it would be much too involved. They need to bring this thing back, and then basically refuel the engine with whatever this is, and they plan on sending these things up time and time again. Right now, they're probably a month or two in between flights. I guess they plan on bringing that down to maybe probably once a week. And then once you get the other three, once you get three of these things running, they'll be able to not only launch from here, he's got an airport or a spaceport, I guess they're calling it now, in Scotland. He plans on flying out of Scotland. I believe he wants to fly out of New Zealand as well. But right now, Scotland and the United States.
This mono fuel engine, Paul, you're throttling the fuel into the combustion chamber of the rocket engine, and it burns. So the fuel has its oxidizer built into it. You got to be very careful with the design of the piping for that. Otherwise, the flame could travel back into the pipe into the tank, if you know what I mean. If there isn't a separate oxidizer, if the oxidizer is built into the fuel, you got to make awful darn sure that the flame doesn't travel backwards in that pipe, Paul, the supply pipe.
Yeah, I think it's similar to a solid booster. You know, a solid booster is basically, you know, you take, for instance, powdered aluminum and you know, coat it, you know, mix it up with epoxy and everything, and coat the inside of a tank, a big long tank, and that whole thing is your engine. And that's the way a solid booster works. And you know, it's got an open core down the middle, and everything shoots down the middle, and that's how you get your thrust. I think it's that type of design, except with rubber.
In the case of a solid rocket booster, the oxidizer is built into that solid fuel, and I guess the only thing that controls the burn rate is the geometry of the hollow core down the center. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yes. When I first saw this design years ago, I thought, well, maybe they're going to be just picking up air, you know, because, you know, it's a suborbital flight. They get up so high, and that's it. I figured, thought maybe it was a hybrid type of engine in that respect, but it's not. I mean, it's rubber, whatever this mixture is. Maybe mixed with nitric oxide. I'm imagining that. I don't know. I'll have to read more about it there. But, you know, it's a popular chemical that they use. So, I don't know. We'll have to see. I want to find out about the first one, why they didn't like the first one. And then we'll go from there. Apparently it wasn't enough thrust, and I think they had some kind of maybe misfires that would go off and on. I think they had some intermittency with it, as I remember. Back to you, Dick.
Do we know roughly how many people have signed up for this space flight? Have they put down a deposit? Has he got 30 people on standby, so to speak, Paul? Go ahead.
Well, in 2012, he had 700 people that put down payments, whatever that might be, 10% or whatever it is. And out of that group, after the accident, they said about 100 disappeared, according to the articles I've read. And that left around 600. Now, he doesn't want to take any more. He's not going to hand out any more tickets until this first group is gone, which is going to take some time. But, I mean, his theory is, you know, hundreds of people will be going into space because it is space, even though it's suborbital, getting their astronaut wings. And, you know, we're up to, I think, around 570 people that have flown into space, you know, out of all the countries. I think we're up to that number now. He plans on doubling that inside of a year or two. So, you have to get rid of the first 600 people first, and then he's going to start taking more $250,000 from each person.
That is amazing. That many people. Wow. And they're actually really in space, weightless for 6 minutes at $250,000. That's $50,000 a minute for the weightlessness. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, well, people, I think they'll line up to do it. You know, and he hopes it's as common as flying into the Grand Canyon with a helicopter. I don't know if you saw that documentary. It was on recently on National Geographic. Two guys hiked the whole length of the Grand Canyon, and they got toward the end, and they showed an area. They said, here's the first flight. They showed a helicopter coming in, and they're still hiking through during the day. He says, over that period of that day, 400 helicopters have come in, landed, and then taken off. And he goes, this happens 7 days a week in the Grand Canyon. Now, I don't know what that costs for one flight, but, you know, people will do stuff like that. Some people wouldn't even get into a helicopter, you know. Oh, I'm not going in there. You know, it's the same thing with this. Inside of 10, 15, 20 years, I think this is going to be so commonplace, you know, you're not going to read about it. Okay, next thing I wanted to talk about is the SpaceX has cargo vehicles, the Dragon. Well, that's been going up. They've gone up like 15 different times to resupply the space station. They're finally getting to the point where they're going to be able to put a crew on the Dragon. So he's built the Dragon crew vehicle. And they're down at Cape Kennedy now. And it's already been out to Launch Complex 39A, where they're going to launch this thing. They've test fired the boosters of the Falcon 9 Block 5 version, the upgraded version of the Falcon 9 booster and whole rocket, including the second stage. Everything is up and running. They got the okay from all the powers to be, including NASA, to test fly the first crew Dragon vehicle without a crew. And that will be going up March 2nd, in the middle of the night, like at 2:48 a.m. It's a Saturday night, March 2nd. And that will be going up to the International Space Station, and they'll be docking with it. And different from the cargo version, when the cargo goes up by itself, it gets near the space station, gets in around 30 or 40 feet, and this 57-foot long robotic arm reaches out, grabs it, and then they berth it to one of the nodes, and then they can unload it. And when they do that, it's got this 16-volt pattern. It goes up against the Harmony node or the Unity node, and these 16 bolts, get driven in electronically, and it seals it, and they can open up the doors and take everything out, put all the old stuff in. A couple of months later, it disconnects and goes back to the Pacific Ocean under each yielded parachute. That's the way it works. The crew version is going to go up, again, autonomously. It's going to get near the space station, but instead of berthing with the space station, it's going to be docking with the space station. The space station will eventually have two docking ports for visiting spacecraft with a crew inside. I'm not talking about the Russians, I'm talking about the Americans. We'll be able to have either Boeing's Starliner, which is being built, that should be going through the same test probably within, 3 or 4 months. That will be doing very, very similar to what this flight is doing, except it's going to be launched instead of on a Falcon 9. Starliner will be launched on a Atlas V rocket. And after that, it's successful. And after this flight is successful, the next flight will be with a crew. I'm expecting that to be this summer. And by that time, they should have all the results from this test flight, make sure all the bugs have worked out of it, any kind of problems that they see, they'll be able to fix up, and we'll be able to start launching crews from the American soil, which goes back to what Roy was talking about, why the Russians all of a sudden are going to have empty seats. They're going to need to fill them, and if they can get some rich guy to pour $70 million into their corpus, they'll be very happy. But meanwhile, NASA will have a place to put astronauts. European Space Agency will have a place to put astronauts on either one of these two vehicles, the Starliner with Boeing or with Crew Dragon with SpaceX. But yeah, when the vehicle gets up there, and there's two docking ports. Right now we have a complete docking port where this one is going to go. There's a PMA, they call it PMA, pressure mating adapter, that's part of the space station, where the shuttle used to dock with. The shuttle had a different docking adapter, so they needed a new docking adapter. So a few years ago, SpaceX sent up an international docking adapter. They call it ITER. And ITER was attached to this PMA pressure mating adapter system that the shuttle used to dock to, and it was permanently attached with a spacewalk. hook up data cables and power cables, and, you know, even fuel transfer cables, you know, everything. So it's ready to go. There'll be another IDA sent up probably within a few months. Right now, this one is attached to the Harmony node in the front of the, what you call the front of the space station, and that's where they're going to dock with this thing. There's all kinds of brand new HD cameras out there. We'll be able to see this thing as it's coming up and docking. It should be really cool. And when they do finally dock, they'll be able, the crew that's up there, there's three people right now, one American lady, one fellow from Canada, and a Russian. They'll be able to open up the door on crew Dragon and go inside. So in reality, it's you know, you're going to have people inside of a flying spaceship that's leaving Earth. And the only difference is they're not going to be coming back on it, but they will go in there, unload it, and they'll actually put stuff in there as well. In fact, I think they're bringing part of a space suit back that they were having problems with. And then a couple of days later, I think, now this is going up on March 2nd. I think by the time they dock and everything and it gets ready to leave, it will be March 8th. And again, they'll have these fancy cameras. They're all set up. They've set these things up over the last couple of months. You know, they'll go out and do an EVA. You know, they'll be changing batteries or something. And they'll always have a get-ahead work on an EVA. They've mounted these cameras in certain strategic locations, different antennas for working with the spacecraft as it approaches. They've got LIDAR mechanisms that the spacecraft could look at the International Space Station to tell where it is, you know, reference to actually making a picture of the space station as it approaches. Really cool stuff. So hopefully that will go good. There's a lot of news conferences, not a lot, but I think around four news conferences and then a post-news conference that they're going to have. And, you know, they've actually had the first one already. They keep repeating that first one that was the other day, on Friday, about this type of mission, all the information that you can possibly imagine on the NASA TV station. And they keep repeating that. Now there's another one coming up on the 28th for Thursday. And then there's another one for March 2nd. They'll have another news conference right before launch, and then they'll have the launch itself at 2:48. And then they'll have March 3rd, another news conference, and so on and so forth. I posted this, I gave this to Roy, so you could look at the list and the times that it's on, including the launch itself. I know that, you know, it's 2:48 in the morning. Not too many people are going to be up for that. But what's good about NASA anyway, they'll show replays of the launch. If you can't get up and watch this thing. And they'll also have some replays of these news conferences. But if you want to see the actual news conferences, the launch itself, whether or not there's a scrub, you never know. And that could change all the dates and times. But right now it's scheduled for March 2nd. And it's on Dr. Roy's website, so you can go to roy.ac2gs.com and you can find this list that I'm talking about. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. Okay, and eventually there'll be other spacecraft that will be going up that will be docking with these IDAs, International Docking Adapters, including Dream Chaser in the future, that will also be able to dock. Actually, that's a strange vehicle that they'll be able to dock or berth. So, and on to a different topic. I covered Opportunity last week, the rover on Mars that's not flying around, not riding around on Mars anymore because of the dust storm last June. All the dust, they lost all the light, they're solar powered, and therefore the batteries died. They took many months, and many tries, hundreds of times, and they said up to 400 tries to see if they could make contact with Opportunity. and it was to no avail. So the thing's sitting on the planet. It got 14 and a half years out of the mission. Landed back in 2004, January. They said it's got given them hundreds of thousands, over 200,000 pictures back. It's traveled over 28 miles on the planet, so it's a real record holder. It's matched its twin that went up. Spirit did very well too. It lasted 6 years, but with Vulcan wheels and everything, eventually it got stuck in a sand dune, and that one eventually died as well. So you got 6 years out of that, 14 years out of this one. So not bad for something that they were each supposed to last 3 months. So they got, NASA got their money's worth, which means we got our money's worth because we paid the taxes on that. Let me drop it. Okay, I was going to cover the weather station on Mars. We've covered a lot of information regarding InSight. InSight was the is the mission that is now sitting on Mars. Its main mission is to figure out what's in the interior of Mars. It has a seismometer. It's got a mold that will hammer itself 15 feet into the ground to check the heat loss of the planet to figure out, how much heat is in the planet. Does it have an active core? Or is it solid all the way through? And one of the things that helped the spacecraft do all this, it needs to, be very careful with the readings it gets from the seismometer. They have to cancel out other effects, maybe the weather or the temperature or the wind. So on board, on top, they have weather stations. They have a couple of masts sticking up. They take the pressure. They have barometers. They got anemometers. Recently it was 38 miles per hour wind. They know the temperatures. I think the other day it was plus 2 Fahrenheit, minus 130-something degrees at night. So it's a pretty cool thing if you ever want to see what's the temperature near the equator of Mars and what's the wind or the air pressure. They can measure dust devils as they go by. So, you could now go to Jet Propulsion Laboratory and put InSight in and put weather into the computer, and you'll get a weather readings. This will give you a weather reading every day. Yeah, measurements that it's taking measurements every second. So loading it into the computer, and then they upload it to spacecraft orbit on X-band and get sent back to the deep space network on Earth. So that's the story with InSight. It's doing very well. From what I understand, it hasn't started to hammer its way into the surface yet. It's got this mold thing. Once that starts, it might take a couple of months. The idea is to get around 15 feet into the ground. But they do have the seismometer mounted onto the surface. They do have this big cover that went over it to protect it from the temperature of the wind. And so the seismometer is up and running. So we'll follow InSight for the next 2 years, 2 Earth years, which is roughly 1 Earth year on Mars. So you'll get all the four seasons on Mars in that 2 year period. And like every other spacecraft mission that they send up, whether we do it or a different country, you'll get extended missions out of these things. So maybe they'll work for many years to come. This thing is solar powered. So it should keep going, maybe year in and year out, hopefully. Just an update on the Chang 4 U-2 vehicles that landed on the dark side of the moon. by China. It's called Chang 4 and the U-2 rover. They've survived a couple of nights there, you know, 2 week nights. They do have heaters inside, keep them running. So and when I say heaters, that's nuclear plutonium that's keeping the circuits warm and the vehicle warm. Although they are really on solar-powered vehicles. I think the lander does have a radioisotope thermoelectric generator, RTG, where the rover is just solar-powered, but it does have a little nuclear core to keep it warm during the lunar night. So, you know, just to make sure that China wasn't kidding, the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, that's one of ours, which has been circling the moon for 10 years, has successfully taken a picture of both the lander and the rover. The rover is about 400 feet away from the lander right now. And sure enough, it is on the dark side of the moon. And they got pictures of it, and I have seen them. You could actually look them up, just teeny tiny dots, but you can see that they have successfully done something that nobody else did. We haven't touched down on the dark side of the moon. They've managed to do that, and it took them a couple of flights to actually do it. They needed to put essentially a repeater in space. They put one at 40,000 kilometers out behind the moon in a halo orbit. This way it's always looking at the dark side of the moon and Earth at the same time. So when Chang 4 landed, it's able to send up signals up to the repeater in the sky, and they turn and send it back to Earth. And the rover, of course, is communicating with the lander. And that's on UHF. Another mission that just went up, I was talking about SpaceX before. Last week, a couple of days ago, they launched another satellite for Indonesia. You know, which to me is, you know, okay, just another mission for SpaceX. They put another satellite into geosynchronous orbit. But the cool thing about it, on the top of this Indonesian satellite, they put a lunar lander built in Israel by SpaceIL, a company that actually is a private company in Israel that's been building this thing for the last like 8 years and for under $100 million. They set the Cape Canaveral. SpaceX put it on top of the Indonesian spacecraft. This thing launched successfully. It was a night flight, and I got to see it live. And I was watching it on the SpaceX website. Since it's not a NASA mission, NASA didn't cover it. I thought they should have, because NASA, you know, does have a little experiment on board, so to me they should have covered it. But I didn't. You know, if you watch the space, you can actually go to SpaceX now, SpaceX webcast, and you can actually see a replay of this thing. And the rocket went up successfully, and the booster came down and landed successfully on the autonomous barge named, of course, I Still Love You, 400 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean. And they have a bullseye on this thing, on this autonomous ship. You know, the ship is as big as a football field. And this time it landed right in the middle of the bullseye. They are really getting better at this. I think it's the 34th or 35th successful recovery of a booster. They either land them on the boats or they bring them back to Cape Canaveral and land them on solid ground. In fact, they launched out of California and from Vandenberg Air Force Base. And they even sent one back and landed successfully on land out there. So they're getting very good at landing vehicles vertically, just like they take off. But this vehicle by SpaceIL, it's called Barashit. I believe is the Hebrew pronunciation of it, Bereshit, which means Genesis in Hebrew. And the spelling is B-E-R-E-S-H-E-E-T, Bereshit. Lunar lander. It's going to take a couple of months. They're predicting April, I think they said April 11th for a landing. Right now it's in an elliptical orbit. What they did is when SpaceX was launching this geosynchronous satellite for Indonesia, it got to the highest part of the orbit, and before they launched the satellite, they launched the lunar lander. That was the first thing to go. And that will go on many orbits around the Earth. And each time it goes around the Earth, when it gets down to perigee, it's going to be, it ignites the engine. And as the moon comes by, it will eventually be picked up by that gravity well. And they'll have retro engines slow down a little bit, and it will eventually go into orbit around the moon. And then Bereshit should be able to land soon after that, a couple of orbits around the moon. Once they decide that they're going to go down, it's going to take them about 30 minutes. Now, this thing's as big as, they say, a washing machine, so it's not a massive thing. It's only planned on staying there about landing on the moon crater or something. It's just not going to last that long. The reason IL wanted to do this was because many years ago the Google had the Google Prize. You know, you could win like $10 million if you could land a vehicle, build it on Earth as a private company, land it on the moon, take video HD, and then take off again and fly roughly 500 meters, land again, and take HD again. That was the deal, and they needed to have this done by 2017. Well, that year is gone, come and gone, and so that's the end of that, and that's the end of that $10 million for anybody that was doing this. They had 30 companies at one time competing, and this is one of them that they just never gave up, and they said, we're going to do this anyway, and hopefully it's successful. We'll see what happens in roughly 2 months. NASA put a retro reflector on board. This way, you know, if you're in orbit, you can take a LRO, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter that we have. They could send a laser down from that, hit this retro reflector array. And what that is, you know, no matter where you hit it, it's got, this one has eight different like cubes on it, crystals on it. So no matter how you hit it, like a corner reflector, it's going to come back in there from the same place it took off from, and they'll be able to record the time it takes and tell exactly within, you know, an inch or two of where this spacecraft is really located on the planet. And the idea is, in the future, you could have a series of these things all over the place. You know, you don't have, like, GPS system, you know, around the moon. So you could have a series of these things, and as space vehicles go down, they could shoot their lasers down, and it could help with navigation and getting from one place to another on the moon. They wanted to test this out. I know we've done it before. We have one on the InSight mission on Mars, so that, you know, we don't have the capability right now shooting a laser at it, but, you know, we might have something in orbit someday, and they might add that to the spacecraft. So that, I found that fascinating. We've done it before with the Apollo missions. There's been three Apollo missions that have done, you know, left those reflecting lasers on the moon, and they're still, of course, operating. It's just glass, and you don't have to be powered. You don't have to maintain anything. And we've shot lasers many times from Earth, and that's how we figured out how far the moon was moving away from us, you know, within centimeters per per year actually using those retro reflectors. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. One part of that flight that I still haven't figured out they've successfully done, checked a couple of websites, so maybe they haven't, because I think it would have made the news. SpaceX has a ship, and this ship is large. I mean, it's probably 200 feet long. It's a large ship, and they put these big outriggers out on it, and it's called Mr. Stevens. That's the name of the ship. And these big outriggers, there's four of them, you know, two coming out of the starboard, two coming out of the port side, you know, one in the front, one in the back, and he put this net, there's a big net from one end to the other, so it looks like it's about as big as a football field. And the idea of this ship is to capture these fairings that are attached to the top of the rocket. You know, the whole rocket goes up, first stage, you know, comes back, second stage, goes into orbit, they eventually deorbit that, and it burns up, you know, like over the Indian Ocean or something. And then the very top part of it, that's your payload, and it's encapsulated in this large 17-foot diameter fairing. Two halves open up, and you know, when you get it, you know, out of atmosphere, you don't need this anymore, and they separate and they come flying down out of, you know, from out of space. SpaceX has little nitrogen jets on these fairings to guide them in a certain way so that they kind of float into through the atmosphere. And as it gets lower, these parasails pop open, and they're guided. They have these strings, the rigging is hooked up, and it can guide itself, and it guides itself towards the ship. So Mr. Stevens, the ship is sitting down below, and they want to have this thing land on top of the net. They've tried it a couple of times out in the Pacific Ocean and failed. It hasn't worked out. It got close, you know, one time it got nearby, and the fairing just landed in the water. But they would like to do this on a regular basis. So this time they took Mr. Stevens, sent it through the Panama Canal, brought it out to the Atlantic Ocean, and they give it a try on this mission. Whether or not it worked, I don't know. It was nighttime, and you know, I'm sure that doesn't matter. You know, these things can't see, but they're being guided automatically. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. Okay, couple of other topics I wanted to cover, but, well, we're getting low. I'll go real quick to this other topic. The Cygnus spacecraft is another cargo vehicle that's sent up by now Northrop Grumman. It used to be called Orbital ATK, launched out of Virginia. And the Cygnus spacecraft has been docked to the space station for a couple of months now. They unloaded a 7,000-pound material, and then they've loaded up with other stuff. This one does not come back to Earth. It eventually burns up. So it separates from the space station and usually gets deorbited over the South Pacific. But before it does, they use this to launch other small satellites. And in this case, they sent it up to a higher altitude above the space station to launch two microwave-sized satellites that are going to stay in orbit. Then they slowed it down a little bit, brought it below the level of the International Space Station, and launched a couple of CubeSats from the side of the spacecraft. And they've been doing this a couple of times. Now, the goal for these people that are making these CubeSats, you know, they attach them to the outside of the spacecraft. They stay attached for months at a time until the spacecraft is ready to deorbit. And by that time, it's sometimes too late for some of the experiments that they would like to do. They would like to have on board the crew, you know, put the satellites together, whatever they have to do, add batteries, who knows, whatever kind of material is involved in the test, and they would like to attach it to the spacecraft. But they can't do that because they would have to do an EVA. So what they came up with was, as it's still attached to the space station, the door is open on the space station, this thing is still attached, they put this rig on that has these CubeSats in it, and they call it a slingshot rig. and they put it on the door of the spacecraft itself. They close the door of the spacecraft, Cygnus, and they attach this, slingshot gizmo to it, and then they close the interior door of the space station, and now this thing separates, and now this thing could deploy those satellites that were just loaded by the International Space Station. So it was successfully done. That's what they wanted to do. Originally, these CubeSats were brought up by another cargo vehicle, a Dragon, many months ago. And now the crew was able to work on these CubeSats and now attach them to the door of the spacecraft from inside the International Space Station. They don't have to do an EVA, and they were able to successfully do this. I want to talk about that and a couple other things. We can always let go to next week. If there's any questions or comments, let me turn it back to Dick anyway. K2RIW, this is WS2N. Unless somebody has a question.
Your watch may be fast or mine might be slow. I think we got 6 minutes before midnight, Paul. Are you aware of that? So you're not quite as rushed as you think, maybe. Go ahead.
Yeah, I don't have enough time to, you know, cover these things. There's a supersonic jet that I wanted to talk about, that Boeing plans on building that at the funded. It's going to be like it's a passenger jet with 12 people on board. And they hope to have this thing flying test flying by 2023. In 2025, they plan on actually putting people on board, paying people. It's not going to go as fast as the Concorde, and the Concorde, right, that got up to 1,300 miles an hour. This thing will get up to 1,000 miles an hour, but it will be past the sound barrier. So not sure what they're thinking here. You know, if you fly these things over land, they're going to make noise, or are they just going to be for, you know, New York to Tokyo or something? You know, I'm not sure what they're going to be doing with this, but I have a picture of the jet. I should have posted it on. Maybe I'll do that during the week. I'll see if Roy could put it onto his website. It's a real cool looking picture of what this thing looks like with the three jet engines, two on the wings and one on the tail. Didn't want to cover that. But you know what I'm saying? If you want to talk about this, we won't have that much time. There's another moon that they found flying around Neptune. That was Hubble did that, a very small moon. Another interesting topic, and we're going to get to these next week in detail. Firefly is another rocket company. They've taken over Launch Complex 20 down in Florida, so they're also going to build a rocket building facility in Expedition Park down in Florida, right near the complex. So a lot of stuff going on, Dick. Wait until a couple of years from now, we're not going to be able to cover the watch. So.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
When it comes to the supersonic transport, I'm a little skeptical of that one, Paul. Yes, there's been some recent articles of where they've done computer modeling and found ways of making the shape of the aircraft so that it makes less of a shock wave. But still, the amount of fuel you consume is something like the speed to the third power. A supersonic transport, the Concorde, for instance, had a very small payload, a very compact, small diameter fuselage, and was burning up fuel three or four times faster than an aircraft that flies the exact same route. As such, if it wasn't being subsidized by the United Kingdom and France, it would never keep flying. So, economically, supersonic transport is not viable or feasible on a permanent basis from my point of view. Let me drop. Somebody's got to finance it. And so, if I'm flying to go to a meeting from New York to London, and I take the transport, I pay a whole lot of extra money to get there a couple of hours earlier. And then you start asking yourself the question, should I be shipping human beings or should I be shipping signals? If I've got photo telephone on both ends, I can be holding the meeting without moving the people. So to pay a tremendous amount of money just to get there an hour or two earlier seems to me like it's a great thing to brag about, but I don't think it's I don't think it's a wise thing to do. So I'm having trouble believing that that one's going to catch on, Paul. Back to you, KQIW.
Yeah, but it looks like Boeing's picking up, you know, with this guy. His name is Robert Batts, and he's been back in this company, Arion. In fact, this thing is called the AS2. So if you look, put in Alpha Sierra 2, supersonic jet, you could read some of the information. This guy Bass is related to, I think he's a nephew of Edward Bass. Edward Bass is another, of course, billionaire family. And that's the family that really supported the Biosphere 2 project back in the early 90s, where they were going to have all those people live inside, and they did it for 2 years, and supposedly without any food or oxygen coming into the place, it was going to be, you know, self-sustaining. You remember that story? That's the one with Jane Poynter. She was one of the people that lived in there, who now owns an aerospace company. So, her and her husband was in that Biosphere as well. So this is all coming from money. It's part of the same family. It's been involved with this jet, and now Boeing's getting involved with it. So I don't get it. You know, but 12 people, you know, what kind of money are you going to get out of this? Probably cost a fortune. Thank you.
Yeah, great sounding science fiction to have people living in orbit. And with or without gravity, the price of getting them there, the price of maintaining them, bringing them the raw materials, you know, by way of the progress ships, it takes a tremendous amount of resources to keep the 5 or 6 astronauts alive on the International Space Station. And we're going to do this with many families in orbit, at a Lagrange point or in orbit around the moon. Good science fiction, but I don't believe it. Okay, we've run out of time. I'm going to say 73. Thank you, Paul. Good stuff. Thank you, Roy. I'll turn it back to Roy for any final comments, like maybe he wants to repeat the website addresses. This was TechNet number 1,735 by my numbers. Maybe it's really 36. And Space Report number 335, maybe it's really 336. And Science Report number 64, maybe it's really 65. Close enough. Over to you, Roy, for any final. Thank you, Paul. K2, I'll be clear, but listening, you got a here you got a voice.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Thank you very much, Paul. Thank all the participants. Before I give you the mail email address, I just want to mention that Israeli craft's name is Bereshit, which is Hebrew for in the beginning, which is the first word of the Bible. So for all you biblical scholars, that's what that's about. And in addition to the stuff that I talked about, I am providing a link to something called a Fabry-Perot cavity, which is the device used in a LIGO to multiply the length by a factor of 280. So it's effectively a 1,120-kilometer distance. They look like Fresnel lenses that have been coated with a reflective surface. So there's a link for that. There's a link for everything I talked about at roy.ac2gs.com. And if you have any questions, comments, topics, what have you, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Once again, thank you, Paul. Thank you, Dick. Thank you, everyone who participated. This is AC2GS, going clear.
That was good research on LIGO. I kind of thought there was a whole lot of beams going back and forth.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the WQVL repeater. Thank you. tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. tonight at 8:30. This is the WQVL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
WYAR.